Hello, and welcome to the London Writer Salon podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Parul. And each week we sit down with a writer that we admire to talk about the craft of writing and the art of building a successful and sustainable writing career.
These interviews are recorded live with our global writing community. If you would like to join us for the next recording or write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions, head to londonwritersalon.com for more information.
What is the reality of juggling a portfolio writing career? In this episode, we interviewed two writers who've built an audience through journalism, podcasting, newsletters, and books. We speak to Natalie Liu, whose popular blog, Baggage Reclaim, led to her podcast, The Baggage Reclaim Sessions, which has had over 3 million downloads, and led to her writing and successfully self-publishing books about relationships and self-esteem. Her latest book, The Joy of No, was published by HarperCollins. We also speak to Hattie Crissell, a contributing editor of Grazia magazine, who has written for publications such as The New York Times and Vogue. Following her own passion, she started a podcast, In Writing with Hattie Crissell, which has attracted writers such as Maggie O'Farrell and George Saunders. And she recently set up a Substack newsletter to support the podcast. Both writers write with us at Writers Hour, and we talked to them in this interview about their highs and lows, about how they've built their portfolio careers, what they've learned, and advice they would give someone starting today. This was a very honest conversation about the reality of forging a portfolio writing career, and it was recorded in front of a live audience in West London. Without further ado, we hope you enjoy our conversation with Natalie Liu and Hattie Crissell.
And if you're loving these conversations and want to help support the podcast, please rate and review us wherever you listen to us. Each month, we give away prizes to our reviewers, things like mugs and stickers and other goodies. Plus, it's just a nice way to show us your love and to help keep us going. Thanks so much for listening. Hello, hello. Welcome, everyone. Welcome. It's so nice to see lots of familiar faces. Some of these faces we just know over Zoom. And here we are in person. This is so special. First live in-person event in 3 years. Thank you, everyone, for coming out here. So we've prepared a bunch of questions for Natalie and Hattie. Without further ado, let's dive in.
Let's begin. And we start with origin stories. And we start with you, Natalie. Nearly two decades ago, you set up a blog. Things were going badly with your health and in your relationship life. And your mom said you needed to learn to love yourself. And so began an incredible blog called The Baggage Reclaim. And since then, you've also self-published a number of books, and you've got the traditional published book as well. But looking back to the earlier days, why was writing so important to you? What were your motivations or ambitions back then?
When I started, I'll be honest, I'd come across an article, I think it was in The Observer, in April 2004, and it was about, you know, blogging was taking off, and it was talking about, do you remember Belle du Jour? And I remember clipping the article, forgetting all about it. And then I went on a bad date a couple of months later. And I woke up in the middle of the night with a dodgy tummy and couldn't sleep. And I suddenly remembered the article. And 10 minutes later, I had a Blogspot blog called Tired of Men and Other Things That Drive a 20-something Around the Twist. And I was motivated to write because I wanted to express myself. I saw this as an opportunity where I hadn't had people really encourage me to write. I'd had people encourage me to like do art, but not to write. I'd never been confident about that until a teacher at a university was like, you're really good at this. And I was like, hmm. And so what actually motivated me was sharing my stories, making people laugh, and also really just exploring what makes me tick and why I do things in the way that I do. I didn't have any big ambitions starting out. I was like, it's going to have the crack. You know, just, I'm going to have some fun with this. I'm going to write. Within days, I had readers. Within months, I had like about 10,000 people a month reading my personal blog then. It was a very different time. You wrote a blog. You could either reply it in a comment or you could send an email. That was it. Imagine if life was like that now. And so my ambitions over the time, it was when I started Baggage Reclaim just over a year later, it was like, do you know what? I think that there's power in sharing my story. I also think that there's power in vulnerability. and transparency and honesty, boundaried transparency, boundaried vulnerability and all those things. And I thought that if I could help one person avoid what I had been through, or I could help somebody get out of that situation, then I felt like I was giving something back, because the internet actually was very supportive of me back then. So yeah, that's what really motivated me to write.
And do you find that that's changed over the years? So
yeah.
Maybe 10 years into the blog, you've, like you said, over 20 years you've been writing. How have your motivations changed?
So I think a lot of people will identify that once you get into writing anything or creating anything, you become aware of what others are doing or what possibilities there are. So you hear about book deals and, you know, columns and how big you can grow your site. And then obviously social media, like I've been around, like I'll be 19 years blogging in just over a month. So I've been around, I've seen a lot of stuff. And so you start to be like, oh, I should do that. And I should do that. And you start to be like, oh, maybe I could get a book deal. Maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do that. And so there can be that more and more. But I think that how it's changed over the years, the book deal thing, you know, and we've talked about that before, I think that became an ambition of mine that sometimes was very painful. You know, it took about 17 years into my journey before I got a book deal. So, you know, it was a while. So I think that that's one big way that my ambitions changed. Bear in mind, I also started writing full time within sort of 3-4 years of starting a blog. So then you're relying on it for an income. So you want it to grow more and you want it to generate more revenue. But I think a lot of my ambition has been tied up with books, I would say. And it became less relaxed over the years. And now it's heading back into being more relaxed.
Dive a little more into your book experience too, a little later on. Hattie, let's talk about your origin story. So people may have seen your byline in places like New York Times and The Times and so many other globally renowned publications. Where did your writing journey begin as a journalist? What were your early ambitions?
Well, I'm always a bit nervous about answering this question because my path was really sort of haphazard and depended a lot on lucky moments and things that came along by chance. And I would say the first sort of 5 or 6 years of my career was, you know, I wasn't working for places that you necessarily would have even heard of. I started out with an internship at Red Magazine, which really gave me the sort of taste for journalism and features journalism. But from there, then I spent several years in kind of digital jobs working. I worked a lot for Channel 4 on their website, doing kind of editorial stuff to go along with their programs and various other things that now feel quite removed from where I've ended up. But I think, I can't remember what the question was now, Matt.
What were your early ambitions?
Did you
imagine yourself like writing for some of these big publications or?
I think I definitely started out wanting to be a features writer, which is what I've ended up doing. But I just don't think I was particularly clear-eyed about how to get there. I think I was a bit passive the first few years and I sort of just went with the flow and what came up and what was fun. And I also think it's really difficult in London to make a living. So, you know, however much you might have a sort of dream of what you want to be doing, ultimately you have to accept paid work, whatever that happens to be. So yeah, it wasn't, I had ambitions, but I didn't have a very clear plan, I would say.
Yeah. Sounds familiar. I think a lot of us, our paths aren't always clear. Did you have a break, or when was a break? It could have been a big break, but something that maybe shifted things for you.
Yeah, I was thinking about this today because I knew we were having this conversation. I had to go back and look at my LinkedIn and look at my emails and try and work out what order things happened in. But I think maybe about 5 years into my career, I really was starting to feel I want to be doing things that are more creatively satisfying to me. And I was freelancing and I happened to be in New York on holiday and I got in touch on the off chance with the guy who was the editorial director at the time of New York Magazine's website, which was quite new back then. And I was a big fan of New York Magazine and I knew that this guy was British. He was somebody that like a friend of a friend knew. And I emailed him. I think he didn't reply to my first email. And I tried again and said, I'm in New York. Is there any chance you could spare 5 minutes just for me to come and say hello and ask you a few questions? And he was really kind and said, yeah, come in. And I talked to him at the time. I was like, I want to move to New York and be a journalist. That never happened. And he said, yeah, you're never going to get a visa. But he was very nice. And at the time they were starting The Cut, which is now a huge kind of fashion, online fashion magazine, but at the time was quite a sort of, I don't want to say amateurish, but it was a very small kind of blog. And I noticed, this was 2012, that British Vogue was organizing a festival where they were going to be interviewing a lot of designers and famous models and so on. And I emailed The Cut and said, do you want some coverage from that? And that was sort of a foot in the door that I think then led to everything else. So yeah, that was a big moment for me.
Wow. And the media landscape has changed so much since when you entered it to today. What has changed? And let's say there's someone who's back when you were starting and they're about to launch their career, want to have similar ambitions as you. Can you give them a look at the landscape? What can they expect?
I mean, I feel I'm always a bit torn when people, younger people ask me about getting into journalism, because on the one hand, I think it's like the most wonderful job. You know, I've found journalism so interesting and stimulating and exciting and fun, and I've met amazing people through it. But it is getting harder and harder to pull it off as a career, I think. And, you know, we all kind of know the reasons why. There's so much free stuff now that people don't need to pay for magazines and newspapers in order to be informed or entertained. And as a result, there's less money swishing around the industry and there are fewer publications. So many publications have closed even since I started working. And the pay has kind of, you know, plateaued many years ago and has not increased. So relative to inflation and everything, people are actually being paid a lot less than they were 15 years ago. So it's not an easy time to be a journalist. And I think that's why so many journalists have had to find other streams of income or have moved into doing different kinds of writing.
Which is a great segue into what we want to talk about.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, we're not, don't worry.
This is really interesting because this is the reality of what's happening. And we think about this idea of independent media. Both of you have self-directed your career in the sense of you've chosen yourself, you've chosen the platforms where you want to be heard. You want to try and reach your readers directly. And, you know, there's Substack and podcasting, blogs, self-publishing books. And maybe we'll start with you, Hattie, just or continue that conversation. Maybe talking about Substack, actually. Why did you make the decision to start writing on Substack? And do you see that as an extension of your career as a journalist?
Well, it is related to this, really, because I started my Substack in May of last year. And it was at that time I was having a really alarmingly quiet patch in terms of freelance journalism last spring. There was a couple of months where I think what had happened is I had become very dependent on a particular magazine that was giving me a lot of work. And then they got a new editor and that kind of destabilized everything. And the freelancing for that publication disappeared for a few months. And I found myself going from quite a steady income from them to nothing. So I was in a bit of a panic this time last year. And so Substack was something that more and more people were starting to talk about. And I knew people who were doing it. And also it was, you know, an extension of what I was already doing with the podcast, because the two things are connected, my podcast and the newsletter. And it seemed like a good way to kind of keep people involved in the podcast in between seasons. So it was for that reason, really. And, you know, you can potentially earn a bit of money through Substack, and I am earning a little bit of income through it, but it is also, I would say, not like an easy win necessarily. I think you have to put quite a lot in to get something back financially. But
yeah, that makes sense. And I think we find that both with what we do and what, you know, the writers in the salon, just it takes time to build up an endeavor. I'd love to go back a little bit to the podcast, because that's also an important part of what you do. It's, as far as I'm aware, it's not monetized, but it is very, very popular and you have incredible guests on there. Can you take us back to 2019 when you decided to set up a podcast? What was your hope for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've always been a big podcast fan. I like to pride myself on being an early adopter of podcasts back in 2005. They were really, really rubbish at that point, but I was listening to them. And so I always sort of had that ambition to do it. And then I did a year working at Grazia doing a maternity cover. I was the acting features director. And while I was there, they asked me to look after the Grazia podcast. And so that was brilliant, because it meant I picked up a few skills in terms of, you know, what you actually need to know to produce a podcast. So then when I left that, it seemed like a good time to do something that was, again, a bit more focused on my own, you know, passions rather than just work, you know, rather than just earning a living. I wanted to do something that was actually creatively exciting to me, which was interviewing writers. You know, I think obviously everybody in this room is interested in how writers work, and that was definitely my passion. So yeah, that's why I started it. And it does, I do make a little bit of money from it now because I sell sponsorship. So every episode is now sponsored, but I mean, it's a very small part of my income. Yeah.
It's a long game.
It's a long game.
Yeah. And Natalie, so going back to your story, so you've been blogging like way before it was cool, like 20 years ago. And actually you just recently moved from your blog to Substack, which we want to talk about, but I want to go back to the early days, and it sounds like you had some good traction when you were writing the blog, which is not everyone has that success. And you also mentioned that if one person could find value and you could help one person, that's why you write. But was there any point in that time where you were writing? Because it can be difficult keeping up with it. 20 years, geez. I mean, like some people have tried, probably started a blog and couldn't keep up with it for 20 days. What kept you going throughout that time?
I absolutely loved blogging. I mean, I still do love blogging. You know, I love writing. And what it was is that at the time when I started blogging, people were so responsive. I had this really, really engaged audience, sometimes too engaged, you know, because they felt like they knew me. They wanted to terminate their whole life story. You know, my inbox is full, the comments were full. But I really loved getting my ideas out, sharing my observations, putting words to things that people thought were in their imagination that were driving them crazy. So I talked about things that up until then, there hadn't been a name for it. So like one of the terms that I then used in my first book was future faking, which is like when somebody fakes a future with you to get what they want in the present. So it's like, oh, you know, can't wait to bring you to that wedding in a few months' time, or, you know, oh, but my parents are going to love you. And then, you know, you think, oh my God, we're going to be together in a few months' time. And then they dump you the following week. So it was like, it's really common still. And I called it future faking. And now I think I don't know, it's got a crazy amount of searches for it. And I put names to things, often with humor behind it, but I told it like it is. And that was really fun for me. I actually really do enjoy talking about humans and the dynamics behind our relationships. And I think that that in itself, because it was uncharted territory in the sense of there wasn't really a, how should we put it, a blueprint, a formula for how to do this when I started out. And so for the first several years, you know, I used to read something called ProBlogger, which that just seems like a million years away now, but I used to read that regularly. I loved Google Reader as well. So, and I was like, oh, I can just do what I want, or I'll write an ebook, I'll write this. I used to write sometimes 3-4 times a week on the blog. Over the years then, you know what it's like, people come in, this is how to do things, this is the path you follow. And I think there was an element of taking a bit of fun out of it, but I think what was beneficial for me is I generally didn't get too swept up in trends. And so I was always able to kind of keep, for the most part, having fun with what I was doing. And that's actually kept me pretty motivated for most of those 19, 20 years. I've had patches where I've not been so in love with it. And I think that that's normal. I mean, you know, I never knew when I went into this that I'd still be writing, you know, it was 19 years later. So you're going to have periods where you're like, what the hell am I doing with my life? What am I going to do when I grow up? You know, what's my next job? Because you can turn anything into a job, as any of you sitting here know. Once you put time into it, you can suck the joy out of it sometimes.
Yeah. So when people are reading, it's really exciting. There's momentum there. Mm-hmm. And you said a few years in, you were able to make it a full-time thing, mm-hmm. which implies there was some money coming in, or mm-hmm. you were finding money somewhere through it. What did those early days of making money either through the blog mm-hmm. or indirectly or directly to enable you to keep doing it?
So it's important to mention, before I became a full-time writer, I worked for the biggest IT publisher in Europe on Computer Active magazine, which at the time was the biggest IT magazine in the country. And I worked in media sales, and it was a very, very successful magazine. And one of the things that I noticed is that actually that they had sort of 4 revenue streams. So it was like, obviously, the cover sales, advertising, what was the other thing? There was something else in that. And then the fourth stream was like other projects. And I was often involved in that where, you know, people were crazy for buying the binders about the magazine and CD-ROMs of it and all sorts. And so I realized early on, I did not want to be reliant on an advertising model because I know what happens when you go down that road. And so I intentionally went into it realizing I was going to have to find another way. And so people kept saying to me, oh my God, I love everything that you write. I'd love it if you could put this all together in something where I could read it all together in one go. And then I was hearing about ebooks and I was like, huh, I've read an ebook. And so I wrote Mr. Unavailable and the Fallback Girl, part one. And it was something like gangbusters. I set it up with, I think there's eJunkie was what it was called. And so that basically allowed it to send the PDF off to the, you know, to the customer, processed payments in PayPal. Money was coming in like gangbusters. So people were just buying it. When is part two coming? When is part three coming? I was like, this is a bit interesting. And so I realized, oh, I can do something with this ebook. And that's how I made money early on. Because there was, Kindle didn't exist when I think maybe it was just starting. It either didn't exist or it was just starting when I first published my first ebook. That was 2009. And so then I signed up to Amazon. Then I did what they called a create space back then. So I organized to do the print book myself and put it on Kindle. And I mean, Mr. Unavailable and the Fallback Girl remains my most popular book. And I mean, all of them still sell. But it just, over the years, just kept, all the stuff on the blog kept directing people to my various books. And so, and word of mouth, you know, I've been on the tube here in London and people whisper to me, Mr. Unavailable and the Fallback Girl. So it's made its way around and people could buy from me direct as well. And that's how I focused on making, you know, that's how I initially made money from the site, for my writing.
It's such an incredible journey to see that you've served your audience. You've listened to what they're wanting and giving it to them. I'm curious, and maybe this is a simple question, but your early readers, is it very clear to you that they were your early readers of the book or buyers of the book? Were they your early readers of the blog or were you accessing a new audience?
Early readers of the blog, for sure. I mean, when I started out, there wasn't really much out there in terms of what I was doing. I mean, I would be one of the longest running sort of relationships, sort of self-help blogs out there. And I was different from a lot of what was out there, which was, you know, those catch 'em and keep 'em type of sites, get your ex back, you know, type of thing. Whereas I was like, bin your ex. So I was a very sort of very different strand to that. So yeah, it was the early readers of the blog. And then a lot of that then sort of was word of mouth. I got a Google, I will also say, has been very, very helpful to me because a lot of people have found me through being in tears in the middle of the night and searching and asking that. Apparently I come up in all searches. And then they stumble across the site or an old YouTube video from 10 years ago or something, and boom, they're in.
It sounds like a collection. You've actually just over time built up a collection of resources, assets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the long tail of...
Yeah, the most popular content on Baggage Reclaim, I mean, honestly, the most popular posts are more than 10 years old, some of them 15 years old. They just keep being read. It just remains that. I mean, some of them have been read millions and millions of times, you know, over the years. And so there is that beauty of that long-term content. I mean, every day I'm hearing from people going, oh, you changed or saved my life. And there's this, they quote something and I go, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. And I realize I just don't even remember writing that thing. It was that long ago.
So another thing that you share is you've also started a podcast and we also heard in episode 277, you've decided to close that podcast down. Can you talk through why did you start it, given all the projects you were working on, and then bring us to present day? Why close something that seemingly you love?
So, you know, I have mentioned on here a few times, I've been around a long time on the internet, and I've seen the journey of creative work over that time. And I'm going to be honest, there's a few harsh realizations I've made over the last several months that I really think I needed to take some sort of stance over. And what it was is this realization of the devaluation of creativity and what creators are sharing, that there isn't enough respect for that. And this is not slagging my audience, by the way. I think it is the times that we're in and the culture that has sort of been created out there. But there is this attitude, for instance, you're listening to a podcast. Maybe it's half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever it is. To the consumer of that, they see that as, oh, that's half hour, 45 minutes, an hour of work. No, That's often a half day, maybe a full day, possibly even longer if it's kind of the podcast is in the back of your mind and you're thinking, right, I've got to do this, whatever. There's a lot of work that goes into all creative work. And the problem is that there isn't enough appreciation of that. And there is such an emphasis on creating free content. And it has become the way that creators are encouraged to advance themselves. And so you just make more and more and more and more things. And the thing is that, for instance, for somebody like me, I actually really enjoy creating. But you need to have boundaries with your creativity because it can inadvertently cross into overgiving. And so what happened for me was that I think sort of in the spring of last year, there's a number of thoughts sort of circulating in the back of my head, you know, intuition giving me a few hints of what was ahead. One of them was, oh, you're approaching like, you're going to be like 275 episodes and then 300 episodes soon. At what number do you end? And then it was like, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought that there was an end number. I also realized that I was tired from producing weekly content, that I often felt as if I couldn't quite catch my breath from that, because then you produce the thing, you put it out, and then you've got to promote it, because you've got to send a newsletter about it, you've got to put it on social media, and then you've got to make the next thing, and then the whole cycle starts all over again. So then I was like, oh, that's interesting. There's an end to the podcast. There's a number on this. And so then I was listening to a friend's podcast, and she dropped to fortnightly, and I was like, oh, hadn't even occurred to me to drop to fortnightly, because, you know, you bind yourself into these rigid structures as your own boss, director of your creativity. You're like, make it weekly, make it daily, or whatever it is. And I was like, oh, right, I'm going fortnightly. And so much opened up for me. And then I went on my usual break, came back to it. And then I had to do pre-orders for the book. And, you know, it can feel, has anybody here have that feeling, you know, where you feel like you talk about something all the flipping time? My book's coming out. My book's coming out. My book's coming out, whatever day. So then the whole pre-order thing started. And the whole publishing process, I will say, has been quite stressful as well. And it's all rather late. I didn't really understand like the whole pre-order thing and why it was so important, because the truth is customers don't care about pre-orders. There's nothing in it for them. Who wants to buy a book and not see it for months on end? So you have to incentivize people, but you don't understand all the mechanics of why the publishers. So the publisher cares about it. So they make you care about it, which then you make your audience care about it.
And the reason they care about it is because they want the book figures, Nielsen book scan, to reflect on the first week of publication that you've hit a certain target and therefore you get on the bestseller chart.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, most publishers, for most of the authors they have, they don't give you the support to actually make that possible. So that all falls on you. So then there's this pressure, oh, got to generate pre-orders. And then it's like, oh, pre-orders are a bit slow. And I remember sitting there going, oh, this is an interesting set of feelings that are coming up. Shame, disappointment, resentment, frustration. And I was like, oh, that's interesting that resentment is showing up. And what I realized is that I'm guilty of overgiving in my work. And that's changed over the years. I mean, I used to give everything but the kitchen sink, and I do a lot less now. But I had this realization that at some point I had fallen into that trap that I think a lot of creators are in because we're told to do it, which is that if you keep producing and giving, that there's a significant percent, or at least a decent percentage of those people that will turn around and essentially give back and reward you. But what happens if they don't? Like, what happens if you're not actually making the money that you want to make? In my case, actually, pre-orders were slow. Now, what that did is just galvanized me to actually get going. But once I acknowledged the resentment, I was like, oh, resentment's in the house. Need to acknowledge wherever I've been overgiving. And suddenly I realized I need to reevaluate everything I'm doing, because this overgiving is, tentacles of it are everywhere. And I also realized I don't really want, if I don't ever write another thing again, there's so much out there, I'm good. Like, anybody who wants to access my work, there's 278 episodes, I don't know, 1600 blog posts, so much on Pinterest, so much on Twitter, so much on Instagram, so much on Facebook, the ebooks, the e-course, so much. So if I don't do anything again, I'm good. And so what I realized is I want to be more intentional, and I want to really set the tone for myself and value what I create. And that means that, yeah, there'll be some stuff available for free, but actually there'll be a lot more of my work that is not free. And I think more of us need to do that.
I'm curious, Hattie, if that evoked any feelings for you. I saw some nodding, and I'm curious.
I can't believe that you did that weekly for that many episodes. I think that's really impressive that you pulled that off for as long as you did. And I do my podcast in 10 episode seasons, and I wait an embarrassingly long time in between seasons because it is so much work. And yeah, but you are constantly pulled in those two different directions between looking after your own sort of energy and health and other parts of your life and, you know, all of that. And then also feeling like, are you doing enough? Are you doing enough? Yeah.
Yeah. This is par for the course of this path, I suppose. You either are pandering to the machine that's the publishing, or you end up risk becoming your own machine that you try to escape from. It's
something that we think about a lot, Matt. Yeah. You and I always ask each other, are we still finding joy in what we're doing? Do we have the capacity? And if we need to, we'll stop our project if it's taking up too much time. So really appreciate your honesty. I think it's the reality of there's the starting excitement, and then there's the reality further down the journey where you have to be true to how you really feel and be okay to say no.
Yeah. You know, I will say, and I'm sure there's others who identify with this, I'm somebody, if I know that there are people who are waiting on something, you know, you sort of created this expectation of something, I can keep going. I loved my podcast when I decided to let it go. And that's because I was not going to wait until I despised the podcast for that to happen. I wasn't going to be showing up being like, oh God, here we go again. And what it was is that I'd rather go out feeling good about it. But it was also just like, actually, I choose my energy levels. Because a lot of us, we hold ourselves into these rigid routines. Somebody said, you got to send a weekly newsletter. Boom, we're now forcing ourselves to send a weekly one. Somebody says, oh, you've got to post on social media 4 times a day and do this and do that. And we will hold ourselves to that. A lot of us will, because we were like, oh, and then we have fans. And so then we feel even more obliged. And I'm tired. Honestly, I like being in my bed early. That's a measure of how much I love you guys that I'm, you know, that I'm out tonight, because of course I wanted to see you guys. But we have to be good bosses to ourselves, because I can demand a lot of myself and I can suck the joy out of just about flipping anything if I allow myself to really push too hard. And I think we all need to take a look at where we're pushing too hard.
It seems to me that if I think about your career and you've started so many different things and you've continued, you've been able to tap into the joy of experimentation, the joy of creativity, the joy of, you know, not worrying about what other people think, and also the joy of saying no. Yeah. And actually stopping something if it just doesn't work for you. And that combination is maybe the magic that many of us are constantly balancing and grappling with.
Yeah. And actually, in your blog where you announced closing down the podcast, you use a phrase that I think is beautiful. You talk about finding your hard passes and happy yeses. Finding your hard passes and happy yeses. If anyone's kind of struggling with what's a yes, what's a no? You wrote a book about the joy of saying no. Any tips for us trying to navigate which might be a hard pass and which might be a happy yes for us with these projects, with anything we embark on?
I think it's really important to know your why, because it is amazing, you know, given the nature of creativity, you can get sucked down a path of a lot of things. So you need to be aware of your intentions and motivations. And if the reason why you're doing it is because, well, everybody else is doing it, or you're afraid of what it's going to look like if you don't do it, or you think, well, if I do this, then it's going to lead to that, pause for a moment and really reflect on whether it's necessary for you to do it, or whether you can find a more values-driven reason, you know, something that's really in integrity with you. Because honestly, doing things just because it's what everybody else is doing, or because, you know, you think it's going to lead to whatever you think it's going to lead to, leads to resentment. And it can honestly suck the joy out of what you're doing. And, you know, I've seen people give up their creative projects and walk away from that and go to entirely different careers because of doing things for the wrong reasons. I also think as well that I talk about this in the book, but I'm an efforter. So my people pleasing style is very much about effort. It's not enough for me to like, I've got to look good. I drive everything with effort. And what I encourage you to do is to, could you do it at less than the level that you're doing it at? Like, does it have to be a Gambusters, Energizer Bunny mode? Instead of whatever you think your 100% is, try and find out what the 70% is and experiment with that. Because I think also a lot of what creates anxiety and stress and frustration and disillusionment with our work is that we're demanding too much of ourselves. We're putting a lot of pressure on us as well. I think in terms of what to walk away from, you know, we all know what it feels like when we want to do something, right? We also know what it feels like when we're not really that first, but it's actually okay for us to do it. And we also know when we definitely do not want to do something. And we need to start paying attention to our body's reactions to some of the things that we're signing ourselves up to. Because sometimes our body is screaming at us, what the hell are you doing? Or why are you doing it that way? Sometimes the problem in what we're doing is that we've agreed to do something that is not in our best interests. But often, actually, it's that we're going about it in a way that is not good for our well-being. And so if you're putting yourself into a lot of pressure, the comparison, the envy, you know, a lot of us, we've got somebody or a few people that were like, oh, that person, look at them doing that thing and being a little bit jealous and a little bit competitive. It's normal. It's natural. But just be careful of that because it can take you into places where you're saying yes for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And we definitely see that, I think, in the community. It's very easy to worry about someone else's path and have that fear that someone else is doing slightly better than you. But actually, we're all on our own path, as hard as it can be hard to believe that, even for us, I think. But I think coming back to that, you're on your own journey.
I think that's something that's very clever about your group, actually.
Let's hear it.
It's that I think that if you're not part of this community, it can be easy to compare yourself to, I don't know, other writers or other screenwriters, whatever it might be. But within this group, because you invite people to talk at the end of each session and you celebrate wins, but you also have all these ways to talk about what you're struggling with, it normalizes what we're going through. And suddenly you see people in there, you think, oh my God, they have it so together and their life is so amazing. And then they're like, oh my gosh, this really sucks. It's really hard. And you go, oh, so it just normalizes it. And you take people off their pedestal. And I think you stop giving yourself a hard time. I think your group is brilliant for that.
Thank you. Thanks. All of you. That was for all of you.
Yeah. Let's talk about starting again. Maybe this touches upon some of what you've spoken about, Natalie. But for both of you, my question is, if you were to start again today from scratch, knowing what you know, would you take the same path? Is there anything you'd do differently?
I don't know. I think I wish that maybe I'd been a bit braver a bit earlier in my career and maybe pursued a bit more of that creative satisfaction a bit earlier on. But then on the other hand, it's not that easy when you're starting out and you're trying to kind of carve out a career and all of that. I'm not sure that I could actually have done it. Some of the things that I'm doing now, I'm not sure that I actually could have done them 5 or 10 years ago. And I look at, you know, obviously you see, as you say, you compare yourself to other people and you see peers in your industry who are doing incredible things and they're still in their 20s and I'm almost 40 and I feel like I'm only kind of recently doing the things that I really feel passionate about. And sometimes I think, what the hell have I been doing? But I just think everybody has to move at their own pace and that was mine. So, yeah.
When you were considering starting the podcast and then maybe the Substack, did you wrestle with any confidence issues? Like, who am I to do this kind of thing? And how did you get past those? Because now you've published over 50 episodes and you're going strong, at least from the outside. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was really scary. And I think with the podcast, I didn't really tell anybody I was doing it until very close to when I started releasing it. I was working on it for about 6 months before I released any episodes. And I was worried because you never, I suppose what you hope and what I think is actually true a lot of the time as a creative person is that if you pursue the things that you think are really interesting and you think are funny or that you're passionate about, generally, I think that does actually pay off. But there's always a moment before you show anyone where you're like, I don't know, am I the only person who's going to like this? So it was a pleasant surprise when the podcast came out that people, it did find other people who found it as interesting as I do. And I think my confidence grew hugely from that point. I think another thing that has helped, you know, doing the podcast then led me to doing a creative writing MA. And I think that has been really helpful as well in growing my confidence and not just confidence, but I think courage is actually in some ways more important than confidence to be able to keep going even when you don't feel confident.
Beautifully put.
And maybe we ask the same question to Nat. If someone was starting a blog today, if you were starting a blog today, what would you do differently?
I think it's important to acknowledge that, because I get people saying to me, oh, I love what you've done with your blog. Tell me what you did. And I'm going, well, unless you want to teleport yourself back to, you know, 2004, 2005, because I benefit from when I started the blog. You know, that sort of that longevity on Google. But would I do anything differently? Do you know what? I wouldn't change a lot of it. I think that how I went about blogging and sort of that freedom and just like playing around and doing what I wanted to do, I actually kind of miss those times when I actually really did not care about, there was nothing to care about in the sense of, it's like, I'll just do this thing. It's like, oh, that sounds really interesting. I'll have a go at that. Oh, that didn't work. Fine, I'll try something else. But as the years go by, you kind of, it starts to feel a little bit scarier. And so I think if I was going to change anything, I think I would probably change how I reacted to those times when it started to feel like there was more at stake. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of that came from, it's amazing how we can insert a career ladder into a situation that doesn't need it. And so I think that that's what I would change, because I've experienced a lot of anxiety as a result of the pressure that I put onto myself, and I stole some of my joy in the process of that. So I think I would change that. The problem is that you don't get the things that you have now without all the other experiences. So all those things were important. Like, if I didn't have my messy ass childhood, I wouldn't have the inspiration for writing Baggage Reclaim. Like, I wouldn't have all the learnings from all the dodgy relationships. And if so, I can't cancel out all that stuff. And I wouldn't really change much of what I have done. I just wish, I think, in some respects, that I had just gone easier on myself over the last several years, I would say.
And what about from a tool perspective? So blogs, obviously we don't have a time machine, but let's say it's 2023 and maybe someone has topics they're equally as passionate about writing as you were. You've recently moved to Substack. Mm-hmm. Is Substack a place where you would start to tell these stories, or where do you think you would start?
I'm going to be honest. Substack contacted me, I think it was Christmas 2020, I think. And I was like, mate, why would I go on Substack when I have a blog and an audience and a newsletter platform? And to be fair, it made no sense at that time. There was no discovery. And so I just didn't see the point of it, because a lot of the work would still come down to you directing people to Substack. So if somebody had said to me, what are we in April now? If somebody had said to me 5 or 6 months ago, you're going to go on Substack, I'd have been like, no, that's not going to happen. And what it was realizing the problems with the creator economy as such. And one of the things that Substack does really is, from the outset, you can attach a monetary value, whether it's monthly or annual, to people accessing your content. You can decide this is available for free. You can pay all other aspects of it. It's not that that is impossible to do with the likes of WordPress or whatever it is. It's somewhat more complex and annoying to do it, though. Also, they have a really good discovery now. So, you know, they say that something like, I think some people are, 40% of their subscriptions are coming as a result of people discovering them through the Substack network. So that's amazing. So I saw Substack as an opportunity to experiment, and I would most definitely recommend that, because you're within a network now and there is that discovery element. I have refused to put constraints on myself where it's like, oh, you're going to, because, you know, as I said, can really overdo it. So I was like, oh, I could start a Substack and then I could do this on a Monday and this on a Thursday and this. And I was like, oh my God, you are not doing that again, because you're putting yourself into a structure. So it has to be when I feel like it, which, funny enough, is how I started out with blogging. And so what's amazing is that you don't actually have to have, I mean, I exported my subscribers from my weekly newsletter over. But it was interesting that actually, even from what seemed like a relatively small number of paid subscriptions starting off with, bear in mind, I was hardly posting, I still have hardly posted, really, you can make a few $1,000s on Substack in a month from that. I think that that's worth paying some attention to. It's not that money talks. What I'm saying to you is it gets you into a mentality. So I would definitely recommend Substack for people starting out. Bear in mind, you can always take your list from Substack and move over to your website. I still have Baggage Reclaim. I still have my natalielu.com. I'm not letting go of any of those things. It's just creating a different mentality. And here's the funny thing. I am not really doing anything different to what I was doing before, but now I have people paying me to do what I was doing before. Please make that make sense, but actually we don't even need to. it just goes to show how just a shift in mentality and attitude can make a difference.
What you've now asked.
And you know, actually, you know, when you were saying about what you would do differently, I think I would ask more rather than kind of, oh, here's this free thing. Hint, hint. Maybe you might want to buy something. Now it's like, hey, you know, would you like to subscribe to this and pay on a monthly or annual basis? So I would ask more, most definitely, rather than having a passive works, I think, in terms of, you know, passive income, but it's a lot of work, a lot of active work to do that.
So question for both of you, some advice, and then we're going to move into your experience in the publishing industry. But let's say people are feeling inspired maybe to start a Substack, a podcast. Any questions you might recommend we ask ourselves, maybe to decide which medium, but also if this journey is something that we're up for? Questions or considerations we might ask ourselves. Hattie, if you'd like to start.
I think you need to have a certain level of enthusiasm for what you're going to do, and which probably ties in a little bit with what Natalie was saying, that it becomes very arduous to force something that you are not particularly enjoying. So you need to make sure that you really care about whatever you have decided to do with this podcast or this newsletter or whatever it is. And my other piece of advice, actually, maybe Natalie would not agree with, because I think I am on a, well, I was going to say, before I started my Substack, a friend who was already doing it said to me, make a list of every idea that you can think of writing for the newsletter and make sure there are quite a lot of them, because you don't want to get a month into it and find that you have run out of ideas. And so I have a spreadsheet and I have a kind of rough plan and I put things in there just so that I can keep generating content. But I think that that was set up, you know, at a time where I was thinking, oh my God, I need to try and make some income off this. Now I'm a bit more focused on writing a book, so I'm a bit more relaxed about it. So it probably depends what you want to get out of it. But if you are hoping to make it a kind of revenue stream, then I think having a really solid plan is a good idea before you kick off.
Thank you.
I actually agree. I mean, I'm a collector of ideas. So if they were to do a digital version of Hoarders, I would have the equivalent of two houses full of stuff to sort out. I'm like trying to figure out how to like do a kind of digital decluttering at the moment, you know, idea decluttering. But I agree, like, you know, think about what are the questions that people most frequently, like get them all down, like in a spreadsheet or on a list, like those questions that people are constantly asking you, or the questions that you think people will have about your subject, the topics that you think people will want to have. Like, don't start a podcast or a blog for that matter, only having like one thing that you want to post. Because when you're going to sit there in front of your laptop, you know, the following week and you're going, the hell am I going to post? It's a horrible feeling. So have your ideas bank, have things in mind, and actually don't just store them in your mind, like do drop them down somewhere, ideally not on post-it notes like I have or in your messy Evernote setup. What I would also recommend, and I've said this a lot of times about podcasting. So if you think that you're going to start a podcast and that you're just going to record an episode or few, and that, I don't know, that the listens are going to come rolling in, or the sponsorship, or that you're just going to find it easy, or that it's just going to stay exactly the same, it won't. When I started my podcast, I had, this is an example of me overdoing things, I had 5 sections in my podcast that I was producing every week. And so there was like, I don't know, there was an intro topic. And then there was like, I think there was an advice, like a listener question, something that I had learned that week. So it's like 3 main topics. And then those 2 sections every week, 79 or 80 episodes, I did that for. Now, I loved making those episodes, but it took making those 79, 80 episodes, and then my father dying and me taking time off and me only having the energy to talk about one thing, for me to discover, oh, I just want to talk about one thing. But I didn't get to discover that without making those episodes in the other way. And then it was like, you know, another, I don't know, 50, 100 or so episodes later, I was like, yeah, I think I like to kind of do like 20-minute, 30-minute episodes. Not to say that my episodes were like super long, but they were like 45 minutes, an hour. What would it be like if I tried to like aim for 20 minutes, half an hour? So what I'm saying is experiment and give yourself time to get a feel for what it is. Because you start out with an idea in mind of what the blog or the Substack or the podcast or whatever it is going to look like. And the reality of making it is possibly going to be different. And so you need to give yourself a chance to try out that iteration of it and then to take the learnings from that and respond to that. rather than kind of plow on and ignoring it because it's like, oh, well, I've done it this way, so I have to continue. No, you don't.
And when you think about experimentation, when you start a new project, do you have a sense on how long an experiment should run for? So would it be, I want to say someone in the audience wants to start a podcast, should they be thinking 3 months? I'm going to try it for 3 months, 6 months. Do you have any sense or tips on what makes a good run?
So I think that this is one of an it depends ones, because like if you are somebody who's like, I can do this and I have freedom to play and I'm willing to kind of give this a go for as long as it feels fun to do it, then that's fine. But of course, we might have certain constraints, like we might need to earn some money, you know, whatever that might be. So I think that certainly in terms of like a blog, really anything that you're going into, you do need to, 3 months probably isn't enough time. Like I'm actually thinking that generally speaking, you probably need to give it at a minimum 6 months. And then depending on how you're feeling at that point, see what it's like over sort of 9 months to a year. But that's all relative to the circumstances that you're in. And if you're absolutely hating something, you don't force yourself to go and do it for the next God knows how long. It's like, yeah, that's a hard pass. You know, that's an example of where it's a hard pass. Like, don't do something that feels it's like shit for months on it. That doesn't make any sense.
Same question to Hattie. How long would you advise someone to run an experiment if they're starting a blog out tomorrow or a podcast just to test it out?
I don't know. But I mean, when I started my podcast, I do it in chunks of 10 episodes. But my podcast is quite involved. There's a lot of research involved and there's a lot of admin involved. And so each episode takes a few days to make. So I did 10 episodes and then I thought, you know, if these 10 episodes bomb and nobody's interested, then I'll just tell everyone it was a one-off project and I'll just never, ever do it again and we'll forget it ever happened. So that was my plan. But I think the other thing that I would say is expect it to take a while to build up an audience for anything you're doing, because I think I do sometimes hear from people who've started newsletters and that kind of thing and are feeling really dispirited because a few months in, they feel as though nobody's reading it. And, you know, it does take time and you have spent 2 decades building up your audience, which is incredible. When I started at Substack, I had, I guess, my Twitter and Instagram followers, but it's, you know, even now it's not like I'm talking to millions of people or anything. And I, you know, so just be realistic and yeah, be patient. Don't judge yourself too harshly if something doesn't take off immediately.
Excellent.
So we're going to talk about your adventures in publishing. Both of you have landed book deals. Your book is out. Hattie, the book deal has been announced. And we're curious about whether you think everything that we've talked about so far, you self-directing your writing career, your podcast, the Substack, has played a role in some part to the book deal.
Definitely. I mean, my book is sort of inspired by the podcast, so it literally wouldn't exist without the podcast. And, you know, the process of getting a book deal now, for anyone who hasn't been through it yet, you know, when you have to put together a nonfiction book proposal, you have to kind of put your business mind on a little bit, because you have to convince publishers that they're going to make money out of publishing your book. I don't know if it's always been like that, but it's certainly like that now. And so in my case, I had to be able to say, look, this is the success that the podcast has had, and this is the audience, and, you know, these are the people who have supported it and all of that stuff. So yeah, if I didn't have the podcast in particular, the Substack as well, to a lesser degree, because it's newer and has a smaller audience, but I wouldn't have got this book deal 100%. But it also depends on my journalism experience, I think, just in terms of the writing and the profile through that. But yeah, the podcast is a big part of it.
Great, thank you. Natalie, same question to you.
Oh yeah, it definitely, I mean, it took its time, you know, 17 years. You know, 17 years of it. But what was interesting was like, it felt like a long time. And then I was like, well, actually, it was right on time in the sense of everything in its time. I mean, of course, if somebody had said to me, if that was the primary goal when I was starting out, it's going to take you 17 years, you know, the best part of 17 years into your writing journey to get a book deal. If I was hung up at that point on that being the goal, I'd have been like, I'm out. So actually, I got to do lots of other things along the way, including self-publishing my other books. And so, yes, the books I'd already published, the podcast, you know, I've had a decent amount of press. You know, I got my agents who are based in the US as a result of being featured in a piece in the New York Times in the summer of 2020. And so a combination of these things most definitely contributed to me, to my getting a book deal. Keep in mind, you know, I got my book deal in the US and they had a very different attitude to me than, say, what I had experienced here in what little I'd ventured through other agents trying to get a publishing deal here in the UK. All the stuff I'd done didn't really kind of seem to make any difference here. It was like, it's not enough. Whereas in America, they were like, oh, this is, you know,
And this is you selling 150,000 copies of your books. This is millions of downloads.
Yeah. So they had a very, very different attitude there, but it all added up. And it was funny. I had like 10 meetings with different publishers. And I remember sitting there and suddenly going, you know, you're talking about yourself and you do feel like, am I Billy bullshitting here? You know, like, because you're talking about these things that you've done and this experience, you know, over the years. And I was like, actually, I've been done all of this stuff. So it all adds up in its own way.
Yeah. And a lot of people can look at getting the book deal as like the pinnacle. This is what we're aiming for.
Yeah, it's not. It really isn't.
Yeah. Can you tell us, because you have, you know, such a wide experience of success before that. What, some of the reality of entering this industry as an outsider.
The reality of publishing is that it's messy. Like you imagine, you know, I got a decent book deal. You know, I got a mid six figure book deal for one book. Yeah. So you imagine that because of that's going to give you decent experience. Oh my God, it has been an amazing. I actually think that there should be such a thing as like a book therapist or an author therapist.
I think that's what we're trying to build here.
Honestly, like you, because you
come need to Writer's Hour if you want therapy.
You need it for support through that process. And don't get me wrong, like, you know, the first one was all right, bar the fact that the contracts took far too flipping long, which means the money took far too long. And publishers expect you to start working without the money. I mean, what kind of messed up stuff is this? Like, where else do you work, you know, for no money? And what I found so stressful about the process is the politics of publishing. It feels like, I think in publishing, it's a bit like we've got a few horses or a number of horses, and we've got maybe one or two that we'll put a punt on and we'll throw our energy into that, typically celebrity horses. And then the rest of them, we'll just let them kind of hobble along down the track. And whichever ones kind of seem to be getting like to the line or over the line, okay, then we'll jump in and we'll support the horse then, probably when the horse is all busted up and broken from the exhausting journey all the way to there. And then they'll be like, oh yeah, now we'll take the credit for like their success, you know, sort of getting to that point. And so for me, like my publisher was fired and actually my editor left not long after I put in my first draft. She did come back to freelance edit the final draft. And then people were leaving and then my publisher was fired and then it was crickets for a few months. And thankfully my book had been moved from October to January because this all happened last summer. And then it was like, hello, what's going on with my book? And it was kind of messy and last minute and very sort of firefighter. It's not the feeling that you want to have. And on top of that, it hobbles you in the process because, you know, when you're repeatedly told, and it is true, you do need a good 6 months beforehand to promo your book and you get about 2.5, it sets the stage for what comes next. And so, look, I'm grateful. I get to say this while also having had a decent sized book deal. God knows what I'd be saying to you if they'd been like, oh, here's a grand, you know, which does happen to some authors out there or, you know, whatever it is. God knows what I'd be saying then. But it's been anxiety inducing. It has been stressful. I've had to grieve because this is not, I didn't get the book experience that I was told that I was going to have. Maybe I was naive and actually believing the publisher, because apparently this happens to lots of people. But you grieve those disappointments that not having the launch experience that you thought you were going to have. And also so much falls on you as an author. I don't think people realize this, that unless you're a celebrity, a lot falls on you. It's a lot of it is you go do that. You go do that. You go push that. It's exhausting. I've enjoyed actually, because I found joy in saying no to exhausting myself in the name of promoting a book. It means that I've gradually found my fun and my joy with it. And so it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so you do see all these people, oh, my book's come out and I'm a New York Times bestseller, Sunday Times bestseller, blah, 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 blah. That's not my experience. And it's not most people's experience. And so I trust that the book will find its way out into the world. And it is. and that it will, you know, make its way into the hands of the people who are supposed to have it.
Thanks for your real talk, Natalie. Appreciate it. Hattie, what's your experience?
That's horrifying. I'm joking.
When's your book coming out?
My book is, well, I haven't written it yet. Okay. So I've started. It's coming out next autumn, next year. And I mean, I've heard similar stories to this from several people I've interviewed or friends and stuff. So I don't think Natalie's experience is a one-off. There are also, I think, better experiences. But I think it's also the kind of another reminder of trying to focus your energy on things that you actually enjoy, because that goal that you have in your head that's going to be amazing when your book comes out or whatever may not pan out the way you picture it. So I'm trying to just focus on really enjoying the experience of writing this book and trying not to get too bogged down in fantasies of how amazing it's going to be when it comes out, you know.
Well, this seems to be a theme of following the joy, keeping it fun, and some real talk too. Yeah. So thank you for your reality.
Remembering what to say no to.
So, yeah. All right, let's give Hattie and Natalie a round of applause. Thank you so much, both. Thank you so much for your time. Everyone, thanks for listening, and everyone who asked the question, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the London Writers Salon podcast. If you enjoyed our chat and you'd like to join us for the next one, please visit londonwriterssalon.com for more information on how to become a member. As a member, you will have access to our interview archive, to our workshops, and our cozy online writing community. Whatever kind of writer you are, it is an excellent place to make new creative connections and focus on your craft.
And if you struggle to find time to write, you're welcome to write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions. It runs Monday to Friday, 4 times a day, and all you need is the desire to write, something to write with, and something to cheers us with. We think it's the world's best virtual co-writing space for writers, creatives, or frankly, anyone who just needs to get some work done. Visit writershour.com to sign up and join us. Until we write again.